Well, I hope you have been refreshed during the break. It's time for us to get back to work. We still have a long way to go. Would you turn with me to Job chapter 32? And I'm not going to do the review like I've done before, because most of you are repeat hearers. So you know where we started and how we got to where we are. And you have seen this last demonstration of back and forth. And may I point out that part of Job's problems is that he is operating from the basis of legalism just like his opponents are. And we're going to see in the next section that we have some advice. As your pastor said a moment ago, some of my favorite passages in Scripture are right here in the section before us in this next section. Job chapter 32. Let's read that chapter to give us a place to get started. Job 32, verse 1. So these three men, that's Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. He was right, as far as he was concerned. Then was kindled the wrath of, and I'm going to call him Elihu. That's how I grew up pronouncing it. Some say Elihu, or I'll say Elihu, the son of Barachah, the Buzite of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself rather than God. And against his three friends was his wrath kindled, because they found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now Elihu had waited till Job had spoken, because they were older than he. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. And Elihu, the son of Barachah the Buzite, answered and said, I am young, ye are very old. Wherefore I was afraid and durst not show you mine opinion. I said, days should speak, multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth them understanding. Great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgment. Therefore I said, hearken to me, I also will show mine opinion. Behold, I waited for your words, I gave ear to your reasons while you searched out what to say. Yea, I attended unto you, and behold, there was none of you that convinced Job or that answered his words. Lest you should say, we have found out wisdom, God thrusteth him down, not man. Now he hath not directed his words against me, neither will I answer him with your speeches. They were amazed, and they answered no more, they left off speaking. When I had waited, for they spoke not, but stood still and answered no more, I said, I will answer also my part. I also will show mine opinion, for I am full of the matter. The spirit within me constraineth me. Behold, my belly is like wine which hath no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles or wineskins. I will speak that I may be refreshed. I will open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray you, accept any man's persons, neither let me give flattering titles unto man. For I know not how to give flattering titles. In so doing, my Maker would soon take me away. We learn that there are some other folks sort of around as spectators of what has transpired between Job and his three friends. And among those is this young man, Elihu. And he felt like that wisdom, you know, old men ought to know more than young men. They've been around the block a few times, so they ought to speak wisdom. But as this has gone on, his anger has gotten more and more, both directed at Job and at the three friends. At Job, notice what he says here. He's angry with him because he justified himself rather than God. And he certainly has. He's basically saying, I'm in the right. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going on. But I, again, like the old country song, somebody done somebody wrong and it ain't me. And that just leaves one other party here. He's insinuated that God is doing evil. So he justifies himself. That's one aspect of Elihu's anger. The other aspect is against these three friends who have condemned Job, but they have found no answer. They have no evidence. They have nothing except this quid pro quo type of reasoning. So he says, I'm about to pop a cork. I'm about to explode. I'm ready. Turn me loose and let me go. And indeed, man, he comes on like a house of fire. Many of the commentators, when they refer to Elihu, they don't see much value in what he says. They think him an arrogant windbag that just likes to hear himself talk. I, on the other hand, see him as the man of the hour, God's man. I believe he hits the nail right on the head for a number of reasons. And he gives some four speeches in the next six chapters. So we still have a long way to go, and we're not even going to stop there. We're going to go on to look at God's reply. But let's look carefully at what Elihu is saying. In Job 33, he begins to directly address Job. And remember that Job at one point had asked for some arbiter, some mediator who could come in between himself and God. And Elihu is basically saying, well, I'm here for that. I'm here. I'm someone that you can deal with. I'm going to come and try to arbitrate this situation. But he takes a very different approach than these three men. Notice in verse 33, verse 8. Surely thou hast spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the voice of thy word, saying, I am clean without transgression, I am innocent, and neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he, God, finds occasions against me. He counts me for his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He marketh all my paths. Behold, in this thou art not just. I will answer thee that God is greater than man. We're getting to the crux of the matter here. He is going to tell Job that these guys are condemning you on the basis of what they presume you might or have done, right? What they think you've done. Job, I'm going to deal with you on the basis of what I have heard you say with my own ears. You see the different approach? They're dealing with presumption. I'm dealing with evidence, the words that came out of your mouth. You claim that, you know, you can't get a hold of God, that God never speaks, and he goes through a number of ways that in his age of redemptive history that God does speak through dreams and through visions sometimes, or through an interpreter, he calls him a wise man that comes and declares to him the ways of God. And he says, you know, God's not here to destroy you. He's here to correct you. He's here to restore you, and he will do it as soon as you learn the lesson. But you haven't learned the lesson yet, Job. You haven't learned what's going on. In Job 34, he mentions a number of claims that Job has made. And I want you to look at these somewhat carefully. In verse 5 and 6, Job 34, verse 5, for Job hath said, I am righteous, and God hath taken away my right or my judgment. In other words, I am in the right, and God will not acknowledge that. Should I lie against my right? My wound is incurable without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinketh up scorning like water, who goeth in company with the workers of iniquity, and walketh with wicked men? For he hath said, notice again, you said this, I heard you. It profiteth a man nothing that he should delight himself with God. Do you see what he's charging Job with? You're speaking like the wicked men speak. That's what lost men say. There's no profit in serving God. There's no advantage to me. You've said the same thing. Here I've served him, and look what I got for my trouble. See the problem? I've heard you say these things. And in verse 12, yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert judgment. Who hath given him charge over the earth? Who hath disposed the whole earth? You know, nobody voted him in. He didn't win an election to get to be God. Job, God is God. He's not trying to be God. He's not hoping to be God. He's not hoping you let him be God. He's God. He's the one who runs the universe. Job, you are out of your league. That's essentially what's happening here. You're questioning the rightness of God to run the universe as he sees fit. Everything has come from him. And if that's the case, he is the one sustaining all, and all glory is to go to him. Chapter 35. Again, I'm hurrying here. He zeroes in on the problem. Verse 2, he says, "Thinkest thou this to be right, that thou sayest, my righteousness is more than God's?" Now, did Job ever say those words precisely? Well, no. But that's the insinuation of what he's saying. Something's gone wrong. I'm in the right. That means God is not in the right. My righteousness is more than God's. "For thou sayest, what advantage will it be unto thee? And what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sins?" What has it gotten me? I've been following God's ways. I'm cleansed from my sins. And look at all this that has befallen me. What did I get for it? And here's Elihu. "I will answer thee and thy companions with thee." And look at his answer. "Look unto the heavens and see, and behold the clouds which are higher than thou." Job, you're out of your league. Job, you need to look up. Now that seems a rather simple thing to say. Just look up. But what the insinuation is there is a realm above you that you don't know. You don't know. It's like the game you're playing here. You don't realize what's happening in the realm above. And you're questioning God's wisdom over things you don't see or don't understand. I love what follows here in verse 6 and 7 and 8. Here's the difference. Here's why quid pro quo doesn't work when you're dealing with God. He says, "If you sin, what doest thou against him," against God? "Or if thy transgressions be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? On the other hand, if thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receiveth he of thine hand? Thy wickedness may hurt a man like thou art, and thy righteousness may profit the son of man." But his point is, it doesn't do that with God. You ever thought about that? If you obey God, if you serve God, are you improving God? Is God a better God because you've helped him out today, you served him today, you worked for him today? You see, that's the way we work on the human level. If I come over and mow your yard, that helps you out, right? Or if I come and steal your TV, I've diminished you. How does your sin affect God? Is he less a God because you sinned against him? Let that mull around in your mind a little bit. This is an interesting thing. I can throw rocks at God all day long and he'll never say, "Ouch." Right? You see, how we relate to one another on the human plane is a very different thing than how we relate with God. He's still God. If the whole world turns against me, if nobody serves him, it hasn't diminished him in the least. And if the whole world serves him, he's not a better God. I could stop and we could dwell there for a little while, but we got to keep spinning here. But let that sink in. Isn't that an amazing thought? Why are you serving God? Are you helping God out? And therefore you think you ought to get a reward because you helped him. He came over and mowed his yard. He ought to give you a payment. He's a better God because you served him. No, that's not why we serve God. And sinning against God doesn't diminish him in the least. I've got too far to go. What time are we supposed to be through here? Okay, a little bit before 5, right? Okay, I'm going to try to get my bearings here. Maybe we'll get through a little early for questions. But I realize we're just skimming through this stuff. But I hope some of these things that Elihu is saying rings true. That he's really hitting the heart of the matter. That Job, you're messing with things you don't know. what you're doing. You need to realize that God is God. He's not another man like you are. He's on a different level, a different plane. Look in Job 36 a moment. He declares here that he's mighty and just in his dealings. And he knows and he warns and he will destroy the wicked. He rewards rightness. But he said if you weren't so stubborn, he would have already have done so for you. But you've not submitted your wisdom to God. You've not humbled yourself before him. Instead, you've argued that you're right and he's wrong. And towards the end, we're just sailing through this. But notice towards the end of chapter 36 that he mentions in verse 27 that God makes small the drops of water that pour down rain according to the vapor. The idea is here that we're going to see over the next few verses is there apparently is a storm coming across the desert towards them. And he mentions here, notice, the drops of water. And then in verse 28, he mentions clouds that drop and distill upon man. Then notice verse 30, he spreadeth his light upon it and covereth the bottom of the sea. Verse 32, with clouds he covers the light and commands it not to shine by the cloud that cometh in betwixt. In other words, there's a storm getting closer and closer and closer. And then in chapter 37, at this also my heart trembleth and is moved out of its place. Hear attentively the noise of his voice and the sound that goeth out of his mouth. He directeth it under the whole heaven and his lightning unto the ends of the earth. Notice now we've got not just the rain and the clouds, we have lightning. After it, a voice roareth, that's the thunder. He thundereth with the voice of his excellency, and he will not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thundereth marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he, which we cannot comprehend. For he says, to the snow be thou on the earth, likewise to the small rain and to the great rain of his strength. You get the idea that this storm is getting closer and closer and closer. Then he begins to question Job with these do you know questions. Look in verse 15. Do you know when God disposed them and caused the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancing of his clouds and the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge and how thy garments are warm when he quieteth the earth by the south wind? Hast thou with him, here we get into the can you do question. Do you have with him, can you spread out the sky which is strong? The point is that you're not on his plane. You're not in the same league. And in chapter 38, out of that storm now, God speaks. And I'm pointing out that I thought Elihu was right on the money. And part of the reason is because what God now does is a continuation of what Elihu is saying. God just picks up where Elihu stopped. That's good preaching. Right? When God just comes along behind and reaffirms what has just been said. And you'll see that happening here now in the chapters that follow, where God now gets into the picture. There's a number of places here. Notice in verse 1 of 38, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, out of this storm. And he says, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Elihu, in a previous passage, I didn't point your attention to it, said those exact words about Job. So God is reiterating some of the very things that Elihu has earlier said. And so now God is coming into the picture. Elihu was questioning Job. Do you know? Can you do? And now we see the same thing going on with God. He says to Job, I got a little quiz for you here. Get ready. Gird up your loins like a man. I will demand of thee and answer thou me. I'm demand an answer, Job. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Anybody remember where you were when God created the heavens? And anybody here? Or where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the world? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures of it if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Who measured it out? Whereupon are its foundations? You know, the old black preacher said God made the world out of nothing and stuck it up there in nothing and told it to stay there, and it did. How does that work, Job? You know, and I realize we in this modern age, we know a little bit more about how these things function than Job, but, oh man, every time we learn something new, the mystery just gets deeper. That's one of the things about modern science. You look at the very large or the very small, and the more we know, it's like the goalposts keep moving. The more there is to know. We're not, I liken it, getting off my subject here, but it's like tearing a car down. You get finally to the nuts and bolts, don't you? The simple pieces. Our universe doesn't work that way. You get down to the atom, you get to the subatomic particles, and you bombard them, and they're made out of quarks, six different flavors of quarks held together by gluons and muons. In other words, it just keeps getting more and more complicated, to the point in quantum mechanics you can't even say that a particle is here or there. You can just say it's a probability that it's here, probability that it's there. And that mass starts looking like waves. There's no end to its complexity. And so even though we know a whole lot more of these answers that Job might have known in his day, we still don't know what stuff is. We can't explain it. I'm getting off my subject here, but you understand, we're just mystified. Rather than the problems getting simpler and simpler, they just keep getting more and more complex. Let's read on a little further. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted to Gore, who shut up the sea with the doors? All of these questions, and I want you to notice that these questions, we go on for two chapters, are all about the natural world, the physical world. In other words, this ought to be Job's area of expertise, right? Now, Job's been questioning the spiritual realm, right? So let's start with elementary school. Let's deal with the physical world first. So Job, tell me what you know. I'm just going to give you a little quiz here. You realize that if you want to question God, you're going to have to pass a little exam here. I mean, you know, you want to be a teacher? You got to pass the teacher's exam. You want to be a lawyer? You got to pass the bar, right? So, Job, here's your test. Here's your quiz. Let's see what you know. You want to instruct me? You want to teach God? We're going to give you a little quiz here and see what you know. Does Job know the answer to any of these questions? I mean, we've just gotten started, but it just keeps going and going and going. And the point is, Job doesn't have a clue about the physical world, the natural world, the world he ought to be able to have knowledge of. He doesn't have a clue. Job is absolutely out of his league. We get to the end of chapter 39 and go into chapter 40. Look at the verse 1. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall he that contends with the Almighty instruct him? You won't teach me? You won't tell me where I'm wrong, where I'm out of? You know, you're right and I'm wrong. You want to be my teacher? And then Job answered the Lord. You remember he had said earlier, I just wish I could find him in his office. I wish I could get a hold of him. I wish I could have a chat with him. I would order my speech. I would order my cause. Like a lawyer, I plead my case. And I know I convince God. I'd get him to realize that something's gone wrong. He's not treating me right. Well, Job has finally got his day in court with God. And look what he says. Job answered the Lord and said in verse 4, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no more. I'm going to slap my hand over my big fat mouth lest I open it again. He's utterly speechless before God. He says, I'm done. I'm waving the white flag. You may be done with God. God's not done with you, boy. He's just getting started. Because there's now a whole nother realm of questioning coming, not over what you know, but what can you do? Notice verse 6. Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me. Will you disannul my judgment that thou might will you condemn me that thou mayest be justified? Hast thou, I always thought this would happen one of these days. I'm sorry. Paula, don't bother me during the service. This is too good for you not to get. Isn't this great? God now coming to Job, gird up your loins. I'm demanding of you. Yeah, give me an answer here. Will you disannul my, let me read that again, verse 8. Will you disannul my judgment that thou, will you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? Roll up your sleeve. Let's check it out. Let's see what you got, Job. Do you have an arm like God? That means, can you do what I do? Can't you thunder with a voice like him? Let's see you command lightning and thunder. I mean, we know what lightning and thunder is today. We still can't command it, can we? We can't say, lightning strike over there. Can you do this? Verse 10, deck thyself now with majesty and excellency. Array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold everyone that is proud, and abase him. Look on everyone that is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked in their place. Let's go out over the town tonight, Job, and do a little king abasing, some king humbling. Can you pluck a king off the throne and bring him down to nothing? I mean, God did that, didn't he? You know the story of Nebuchadnezzar? One day when Nebuchadnezzar is out there looking over Babylon, look at this great Babylon, I did it, it's all for me, it's all because of me. And God said, that's it, boy. Struck him down. Next thing you know, he's on his hands and knees out in the pasture eating grass like an animal. Let's see you do that, Job. Can you bring down the proud and humble them? Can you hide them in the dust forever together and bind their faces in secret? If you can, look at verse 14. If you can do that, then I also will confess unto thee that thine own right hand can save thee. When you know what I know, when you have power like I have power, then maybe we can talk about you saving yourself with your own right hand. But till then, Job, you're out of your league. Let that sink in. He then turns in verse 15 to Behemoth, and in chapter 41, verse 1, to Leviathan, two huge creatures. What exactly every big beast that's out there has been guessed as a possibility of identification of these, I don't know for certain. Nobody else does either, as far as I can tell. But the point is that Behemoth and Leviathan are creatures like you, Job. And yet you can't tame them. You can't put a hook in Leviathan's mouth in 41 verse 2. You can't catch him like a fish. You don't have that kind of power, that kind of strength. Do you see the point? Even creatures you can't control and you can't tame. You'll notice that God never answers the charge of Job. He never gives him an answer. He simply points out that Job is out of his league to question God. It's very similar to what we find the Apostle Paul doing in Romans chapter 9, where we're dealing with the absolute sovereignty of God again. He raises up Pharaoh and so forth. And he deals with this question, is God unjust to do this? And his answer is not to answer it, but simply say, who are you to question God? Who are you to contend with God? That's what's going on here. God somehow feels he does not owe Job an answer. He's not obliged to explain to Job what he's doing. This is like playing chess with a grand chess master who's about 30 moves ahead of you. And you are questioning his move, questioning why would he do such a thing. You understand? You're down here reasoning on this level. You cannot possibly understand all the ins and outs of this. If I can use an old movie as an example, many of you remember Tarzan? You know, who was the girl? Jane. And what was the famous line? Me, Tarzan. You, Jane. Well, what's going on here is him, God, you, creature. You see? You're not on the same level. You're not dealing with another man here. You're completely outmatched, outgunned. He's God. He's the creator of all things, including you. He's the one who sustains you. Remember what Daniel preached to Belshazzar many years ago, there that night in Babylon when he was having his feast. The handwriting appeared on the wall. They had go find somebody to interpret that. They got Daniel to come in there, and he looked at it and said, well, basically it means turn out the lights, the party's over. You know, the kingdom's divided to the Medes and the Persians. You've been weighed and found wanting. But before he told him the meaning of that writing, he preaches Belshazzar a little sermon. He says, Belshazzar, you knew better than this. You knew. The God in whose hands your breath is, thou hast not glorified. You ever thought about that? Your next breath. You think you're self-sufficient? Let's see how long you last without your next breath. You're utterly dependent upon God sustaining you. And it is that God, Daniel says, that you've sinned against, the God who is your maker. That your purpose here is to bring glory to the God who created you. We have a Ptolemaic view of the universe. If you remember, Ptolemy was the one that said the earth is at the center of the universe and everything in the universe revolves around the God. I say, spiritually speaking, we have a Ptolemaic view of the universe, that I'm at the center of my universe and everything revolves around me. I mean, I've got chickens out there for eggs, I've got pigs for bacon, cows for steaks, and I got God over here for forgiveness and salvation. I mean, what else is God for? You say, it's all about me. We need to have a Copernican revolution in our thinking. Copernicus came along and said, no, you got it all backwards. It doesn't all revolve around the earth. The earth is revolving around the sun. They wasn't quite correct. We know more than that today. But at least he had the basic idea that your paradigm needs to be turned upside down. And so it is with our spiritual paradigm. Everything is not revolving around us. It is to revolve around God. You're not here for him. He's here. I'm sorry. It's the other way around. He's not here for you. You're here to glorify him. Let's get this straight. Him, God, you, creature. And the creature's duty is to bring glory and honor to his creator. Not to question the creator. Not to charge him with injustice and evil. But to bow down and to worship. I was in Nashville way back there and doing some programming way back in the early days of the PCs that were coming out. And one day I was trying to show our kids how you could make a little computer game. I'm trying to get them interested in programming. And we had this little airplane graphic that was going across the screen. Back and forth. And then we did a few more lines of code. I was showing them, hey, now we can put a little ship down here on the waves of the ocean going back and forth. So you got the airplane up here and the ship down here. And let's put a few more lines of code in there so that when we hit a certain key, bombs are going to come out of the plane and try to blow up the ship. Okay, this is the day of Pong. You old folks remember these primitive video games. But suppose that we're in the middle of this game and one of these blips on the screen begin to talk back to me and begin to say, "You're evil. You didn't give me as many bombs as you gave that plane over there, and you didn't make me as fast as that other plane. But what would you say?" I think I would say, "Little blip. I made you. I created you. You exist for only one reason, and that is for my pleasure. And if it gives me pleasure to blow you to smithereens, what is that to you? I'm your maker." Do you understand? That's the primary relationship between us and God. We're His handiwork. He formed us for Himself and to bring glory to His name and honor. Oh my. Throughout all of this, God never gives Job an answer because He's God. And He doesn't give us an answer. We're to trust Him. We're to lay hold on the fact that, as we say, He is too good to do evil. He is too wise to make a mistake. We may question, we may wonder about some of the things that are happening in this world, why God allows this or that. But let's remember that we have yet to see the full outcome of what is happening. Well, in rushing through this, I got through a little early, but shall we? Anybody complain? I realize we've just, it's like you just get bombarded by this, and we've just skimmed through so much of it. But shall we stop for some questions? I want you to ask this: how does this last section fit in with what's gone before? Do you see now that here is the answer to all that quid pro quo stuff, and it goes out the window? Here, yeah, Kobe.